Later this week, the concluding part of Hilary Mantel's Tudor trilogy, The Mirror and the Light, will be published. The series of novels shows us the Tudor court from the perspective of Thomas Cromwell, Henry VIII's loyal enforcer and fixer, from the time Cromwell dealt with the Catherine of Aragon problem right up until the time he didn't deal with the Anne of Cleves problem. So what is it about this period of English history that draws writers and dramatists back again and again, from films to television, books to plays? It seems that Henry, his six wives and his illustrious daughter, Elizabeth I, are never far from creative imaginations. To discuss this and the art that comes out of that historical period, with me in studio are author and dramatist Anne Chambers, the writer and satirist Jerry Sembridge, and film critic Chris Wasser. The allure of the Tudors, I'll start with you, Jerry. What is it that keeps drawing storytellers back to this?
I know, well, it certainly isn't that lovely gentle music anyway. That's
for, green that, sleeve.
That's for sure.
So it's, misleading, isn't it?
It's more to do with beheadings and hangings, drawings, quarterings and all the rest of it. I do think that the presence of Shakespeare as an author in the late Tudor period, you know, as an Elizabethan author, and the fact that his plays were so much part of the culture for hundreds of years after that, allowed people into that period in the first place. I think at a very simple level, for example, in terms of actors and in terms of writers, they felt they knew how to write this stuff. They knew how to get at it.
Even though Shakespeare didn't deal too directly with the Tudor period, but he dealt
not
with
at
maybe
all, actually,
he dealt with other periods in a Tudor way.
Well, the language was Tudor, you know what I mean? Like, everything Shakespeare wrote, you know, Shakespeare didn't do kind of fake medieval language or fake Italian dialect or whatever. He wrote, you know, he wrote Elizabethan English. And so we felt therefore, I think, that we knew that language. We knew kind of how they spoke back then and how they dealt with each other and how the relationships worked. Now, that's, I mean, that's very much like under the, if you like, under the surface. But I really think it gave people that confidence to go at it, you know, and feel and feel that they understood how to do it.
How to approach it.
And what clothes to wear and you know, what manner to adopt and how to eat a good leg of chicken, you know what I mean?
You were saying, Anne Chambers, just as we were coming to where you were saying, you know, it's such an amazing period, particularly this end of the 16th century, because so much is going on, you couldn't make it up.
Absolutely. I've spent 20 years of my life, I'm ashamed to say, living vicariously through the lives of people who lived in the 16th century. And to this day, I find it fascinating. It is high adventure. The people are larger than life. The events, as Jerry said, we were talking about it earlier, you know, a king beheading the wives, remarrying, all the intrigue that went on behind that. You come then to it's the great age of exploration. We forget that, and high adventure on the seas. And of course, with exploration comes exploitation of the countries and the peoples who have been explored and discovered.
Which is part of the Irish story,
I guess.
And that's
part of the Tudor conquest of Ireland. So you have all of that activity, these great larger-than-life people. You know, I wrote a novel in but I'm more interested in the in the biographical stories of that period, because I can tell you, if you write novels in that period, people wouldn't believe it.
Yeah, you're making that up. That didn't happen. Yeah, and I guess, Chris Wasser, that's one of the big challenges when it comes to, because you've chosen a number of films and television series that have represented this period.
Yes.
One of the big challenges is precisely that. How do you deal with the history of the period and be true to that and tell a story that's plausible, that's believable, and that has dramatic force to carry it through?
Yeah, it's a bit of a tightrope walk. And in some cases, you know, like some of the films and TV shows that we'll look at, the Tudors, which we'll come back to, they've leaned too heavily in one direction. But as Jerry and Anne have been saying, it is a very confined part of history. No one really talks much about Henry VII. We're talking about Henry VIII, who was this narcissistic, egotistical monster of a man who, you know, went through six wives. Even the people he held close to him were always worried about whether they'd be the ones next in the tower. You couldn't make up the stuff stuff that went on, but it's a screenwriter's dream because you've got this just confined, sensational part of history to go to town with. You've got war, you've got betrayal, you've got the sexual prowess of a leader whom whoever he married, if he was to reform the country, whoever he married next, the country and the politics and everything, the economy, it all depended on who his next wife was. So that's the stuff of screenwriting dreams.
And he shouldn't have been king in the first place.
And he shouldn't have been king in the first place.
Arthur was the king.
Yeah, who was another?
Brother,
who was
his older brother, and he died at 15. He married Catherine of Aragon, and Henry VIII then married Catherine. His
when Arthur died, Henry just stepped into the shoes of the brother.
You couldn't invent this stuff, really.
There's a phrase familiar to film producers. They use it all the time when they read a script. Are the stakes high enough? They ask themselves. And you know, when you look at the Tudor story, certainly Henry VIII story, the stakes couldn't have been higher, really. You know, because you had the fate of an entire religion. You had the fate of a king, all built around the question of what he would do with his first and second. The first two wives in particular are the ones that seem to get all the attention. I think you're quite right. It's very significant that Henry VII is never written about in any
way. What a wily character he was.
A great old character, but, you know, and don't forget the stakes weren't high enough, clearly.
No, but still the king was counting out his money. Yeah. No, that's from that old children's little poem. But, you know, that was Henry VIII.
That was Henry VII.
Collected taxes.
So, Gerry was talking there about this idea of, you know, the fate of the king and the fate of the king's wives, in fact, is hugely important here. Given that we're talking this in and around Hilary Mantel, the third part of the trilogy around this period, from Bring Up the Bodies, which is the second in the trilogy, there's a quote, "God should have made their bellies transparent and saved us the hope and fear." Obviously a reference to women's wombs there. If you're talking about succession, if you're talking about royalty, women and how their bodies are going to be treated is going to be part of the story. Absolutely. Was it even more so in the Tudor period than elsewhere?
I think it was. Look what motivated Henry VIII. It was an heir, to produce the male heir. And that really was, that and money, of course, always comes into it. Mm. The monasteries, as we all know, were the banks of the period. And he needed money because he'd run out. His thrifty father had left him with the good. It sounds so familiar. Thrifty father leaves our errant son large quantity of money and he spends it. So he goes to look for it. But really it was to produce an heir. And then when you move on to Elizabeth, when you think of what that woman sacrificed for the security of England, she sacrificed her own right to be a mother, to be a wife.
Constantly referred to as the Virgin Queen.
Well, yes. Well, we can hop over that a little bit. There's Robert Dudley around there sometime having a peer in the window, you know, at times. But even that, she managed to do that and was perhaps the greatest of the Tudors, in my opinion, because they all had their faults, but Elizabeth really managed to hold on when the odds were so much against her.
All right, let's go to a film representation then. And I know Gerry mentioned Shakespeare as the daddy of them all, but if you take modern filmmaking, the latter part of the 20th century, A Man for All Seasons is going to kind of be the daddy of them in this particular case, Chris, I think.
Yeah, that's right. And the one thing I love about this film is that Robert Bault,
he was the man
behind the stage version, and that Robert Bault was allowed to adapt his own play for the screen back in the 1960s was a huge thing, that a studio would allow him to do this, and also that they'd allow him to hire some of the actors who actually played the part of Moore and played the part of the royal family on stage, on screen. That was another big coup, because the studio behind this said, we want the likes of Richard Burton, we want the likes of Alec Guinness. But
explain. Just give us the context here for Thomas Moore and where he fits into the story.
Yeah, so Thomas Moore was the poor fella, to simplify things, who opposed Henry VIII's annulment from Catherine, and he just wouldn't stand by while Henry VIII wanted to be the Church of England. So he would eventually lose his head for it.
Yeah, and this is kind of where Thomas Cromwell and the Hilary Mantel, but this is where Cromwell comes into his own, because he's there to take over that position of advisor. Yeah. Let's have a listen to a clip from the Man for All Seasons, Robert Bolt playing the character of Moore in this clip.
Arrest him.
For what?
He's dangerous.
For libel, he's a spy.
Father, that man's bad.
There's no law against that.
There is God's law.
Then God can arrest him.
While you talk, he's gone.
And go he should, if he were the devil himself, until he broke the law.
So, now you'd give the devil benefit of law.
Yes, what would you do? Cut a great road through the law to get after the devil?
Yes. I'd cut down every law in England to do that.
Oh? And when the last law was down and the devil turned round on you, where would you hide, Roper? The law's all being flat. This country is planted thick with laws from coast to coast, man's laws, not God's. And if you cut them down, and you're just the man to do it, do you really think you could stand upright in the winds that would blow then? Yes, I'd give the devil benefit of law for my own safety's sake.
Paul Scofield there in Robert Bolt's cinematic reimagining of his own play, A Man for All Seasons. What's great about A Man for All Seasons, I think, Jerry, is this: they actually managed to get the complexity of the politics in there, as well as all of the sexual shenanigans and the other shenanigans that were going on. It's important to have that balance, isn't it?
Well, I think that every period writes about another period in terms of, you know, what's important to them at that time. So Man for All Seasons was very much about integrity and morality and the singular man represented in this case by Thomas More, who is definitely not represented in the same way by Hilary Mantel, who is, you know...
Well, he kind of disappears, he's gone, literally.
Is created in an entirely different way. But that it's very much a 60s phenomenon, I think, that idea of the person who stands against authority and who holds himself to some kind of higher position and wins by not bending to that. And I think that the time in which it happened is very significant, so that I don't think Thomas More would be a hero for now. He would be, but it also kick-started that whole, there was a whole phase of I was a child at that time, and I remember. Just how much Tudor drama was coming
out. Jackson.
Yeah.
God, the greatest incarnate.
Who played Elizabeth I?
Elizabeth I, and she played her from the mid-20s to the 70s. I can still remember as a kid watching that and just being mesmerised. And I don't think, in my humble opinion, there hasn't been a better representation of Elizabeth from what I know about from my historical research.
And what is it about the historical character that makes Elizabeth then such an attractive role for an actor to play?
Well, I think firstly she's a woman, you know, very much in a man's realm, which was then considered a male realm. All the other female queens had been.
And sorry to briefly interrupt, but it was in 1971 when second wave feminism
exactly, and that was nearly a kind of an indicator of it, that Glenda Jackson portrayal of this great woman, because Elizabeth up until then we really hadn't seen a lot about her. There was an awful lot about Henry VIII, of course, and he's larger than life. But I think also that depiction of Elizabeth has never really, because what they did with that series, and went on for forever, I think
six 6.5-hour episodes, something like that.
Is that all it was?
An hour and a half, though. An hour and a half. So you're talking about,
and
you
it really
9 hours.
Stayed so true to the factual story, and I think that's what makes these historical dramas, if they do, and you talked, Jerry, about the language, if you use part of that language, sometimes it can alienate your listener, but I think if you use even idioms of that language, it also gives it that kind of authenticity that the character is trying to bring, and you have the language as well.
And Elizabeth, something like A Man for All Seasons, though, it was probably the culmination of 4 decades worth of films and television productions about the Tudors, where you saw something happening where finally someone is able to combine the historical accuracy of these events with drama, because almost as like the Tudors on screen is almost as old as cinema itself. Some of the first films ever made in 1911 and 1912, just 5 or 6 years after the birth of cinema, featured King Henry VIII and featured Anne Boleyn, and they were kind of comical silent shorts. And then you had in the 1930s more kind of sophisticated offerings, but they were all quite silly. They were always going for the laughs. A Man for All Seasons, as stagey as it still is, it is quite sharp, it is quite witty, it's a hell of a lot better than the version we eventually got, a version starring Charlton Heston, but we probably shouldn't visit that at all. You saw that, okay, this is something that we're able to do right on screen. It's beautiful to look at. I would argue, however, that Elizabeth, or the woman Glenda Jackson, that was almost literally a filmed play, and
that was a particular style, though, at that time.
Yeah,
wasn't it?
It was.
But sticking with that character of Elizabeth, because you chose a few different Elizabeths.
Yes,
Kate Blanchett, How do you feel about her portrayal, first of all?
Soapy, melodramatic, chewing up all the scenery, but quite brilliant, because Cate Blanchett, specifically the first time she played Elizabeth, because she would play her again 10 years afterwards, she realised that I'm dealing with a myth as much as a real person here. And the only way to tackle that is to go over the top. And that film is very much over the top, but it's probably one of my favourite portrayals of Elizabeth.
And is this the one where she's Joseph Fiennes playing the aforementioned Dudley that you mentioned earlier on? Elizabeth, do you believe it?
I wouldn't believe that. Yes, I think they were, because they go back to childhood romance, you know, and he was very, very, they say that he murdered his wife because he hoped to be Elizabeth. But what did Elizabeth say? If I marry you, I will lie down as Queen of England and rise next day as mistress.
Right, well, let's have a listen to a clip from Elizabeth then, with Cate Blanchett playing the Royal and Joseph Fiennes playing the part of Dudley.
You must let me explain. Others will take advantage of this. You must not believe what they tell you. They are jealous and envious, because I am nothing to them and everything to you.
Do you love her?
No, I love you. I have always loved you. I was afraid of losing you because I was not free. For God's sake, you are still my Elizabeth.
I am not your Elizabeth. I am no man's Elizabeth. And if you think to rule her, you are mistaken. I will have one mistress here. And no master.
That's pretty clear stuff from Cate Blanchett as Elizabeth I and Joseph Fiennes there as Dudley in that scene from Elizabeth, the movie.
Can I just say, maybe I had my fill in the 60s and 70s, you know, with Keith Michelle as Henry and Robert Shaw as Henry and as you rightly say, and that sensational Glenda Jackson, you know, that I was just completely over this period until Hilary Mantel.
Well, I was going to ask you,
I couldn't be bothered seeing any of those films.
Why has Hilary Mantel, you know, captured the imagination so well? Obviously, with these books, the trilogy, double Man Booker winner, remember, for the first two. Will she be a triple with the third one? We'll have to wait and see. But also the television series. What does she do, Anne, would you say, as an historian? Because she is dealing with, she's clear that she's writing fiction, but
I'm a biographer rather than a historian, because I'm always want to get the person behind the historical facts. But I must be the only one on the planet to say that I found Wolf Hall very, very dense almost to get through. Cromwell to me was a character that I would never think of making a novel about. There were far so more interesting characters and more colourful and more characters that make a bigger impact. But I think really what Mantel has done is she has, as Jerry said, we got tired of this period, but now it's back. And I think you're going to see Hollywood and everybody else following suit now. And I'm just hopeful that somebody quite close to my own orbit might get in there as well.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think it's going to highlight the Tudor period again.
For me, it was all about, from a literary point of view, you know, she just did something extraordinary. And it was extraordinary, from the first page, that you were within the mind of someone. She shifted the perspective away from the actual normal main players, from Anne Boleyn, from Thomas Cromwell. And from page one, you're inside his head. And so you are immediately interested, for me, because you're suddenly saying, "Oh, let's see this now from a very different point of view."
Yeah.
And so as a book, that can be sustained. Oh, the other big thing, which people argue about, but I loved it about it, is her choice of the present tense in the books are written in the present tense. So when you combine those two things, you're in the mind of Thomas Cromwell and you're in the present tense. Then there is nothing about the book that is foreseen. You know what I mean? There's nothing that you're going to...
Yeah, it's happening in front of your eyes as you read. Let's listen to... Obviously, there was the big television adaptation as well.
And I wondered... Well, Chris will want to talk about that, but what I particularly wondered was how they were able to deal with that in the...
Let's listen to a clip that features Mark Rylance as Thomas Cromwell, and it's Claire Foy who's playing Anne Boleyn, and she's finding out just how Machiavellian Cromwell can be in this scene.
I'm told that when you thought the king was dead, your first action was to send for the bastard Mary. You did not think of me, or my daughter, or the child I was carrying then.
I cannot hold the throne for an infant in the cradle. I cannot hold the throne for an unborn baby.
I promoted you. I am responsible for your rise. And at the first opportunity, you've betrayed me.
Madam, nothing here is personal.
What a great line. Yeah, unless it's your head, we were saying upstairs, yep. Or your body if you're a woman, nothing is at all personal. That's Claire Foy and Mark Rylance in the television adaptation of Wolf Hall. Really noticeable there is how sparse the production is. You know, it's very much concentrated on the dialogue and the characters. Very different from other representations of the Tudors, in particular, The Tudors, that TV series.
The Tudors, because, and I'm afraid after this comment, there'll be a giant Chris Wasser-shaped hole in the wall, but I actually haven't read the Wolf Hall novels. I had seen the series, yeah. Yes. And it's interesting that Anne used the word dense, because my wife loves the novels, and she had said to me after I watched the television show, I'm not sure if you're going to like the series, because they are two different beasts entirely. I mean, Peter Straub in particular was commended for having condensed 1,100 to 1,200 pages worth of material into 6 hours of television.
And then the whole thing was lit by candlelight?
And the whole thing was lit by candlelight, which I remember watching and thinking, this is brilliant. Not only have you hired Mark Rylance, you've hired Jonathan Pryce, Damian Lewis, Claire Foy, fabulous thespians and brilliant actors of the screen. You're also going to great lengths here to make this look as authentic as possible. And then I was just flabbergasted that some critics and viewers on Twitter in particular were picking up on, oh, it's too dark. Now, some of the actors did come out and say, we were actually tripping over one another on set because we weren't using electronic lighting or electrical lighting. But I quite admired that, because I was coming off the back of Showtime Network's The Tudors, which I know had a huge audience. It was one of Showtime's biggest hit in years. But I mentioned earlier, some shows, some films have leaned too heavily in the one direction. In the wrong direction. The Tudors did that. They took Henry VIII and they thought, what if he was handsome and just so sexy? And what if he looked like Jonathan Rhys-Meyers? And what if we condensed the Tudor period into just what looks like a year for Henry?
Well, let's listen to a clip to get the difference in style then with Jonathan Rhys-Meyers as Henry. Very good looking Henry, it has to be said.
Yes,
and slimmed down Henry.
Henry.
And it's Maria Doyle Kennedy who's playing the part of Catherine of Aragon in this scene.
You have not answered my nephew's letters.
Just because your nephew is the King of Spain, does he think I have nothing better to do?
You know he advises you to sign a treaty with the Emperor, recognizing France as our mutual enemy. He also advises you not to heed everything Wolsey tells you, because Wolsey is so biased for the French.
Since when are you a diplomat?
I am my father's daughter.
You are my wife. You are not my minister. You are not my chancellor. But my wife.
I should like to be your wife in every way. Henry, will you not visit my bedchamber as you used to?
Maria Doyle Kennedy and Jonathan Rhys-Meyers in a scene there from the TV series The Tudors. I can't believe
nobody had looked at the Holbein portrait of King Henry when they cast Jonathan Rhys-Meyers as the. I think by series four he was still just as slim
By the time it finished, they fast forwarded and put some false facial hair in there and a few extra pounds. I think he was wearing a fat suit to make him look like the real Kennedy.
Okay, well look, we've a minute left then for your wish list of what happens now with the Tudors. What do you want to see? You're looking forward to the third part of the trilogy, the book anyway, Jerry.
Oh, hugely.
And what do you want to see? And
I want to see the writing. I want to, the writing to be as good as it was in the first. I mean, for me, it was all about the writing. It's a really remarkable.
Chris, will you now go and read the trilogy?
I might
have a conversation with your wife about it.
As I said, I've been advised not to, but I'll give it a go.
If you had to choose one other character in 30 seconds, Anne Chambers, from the Tudor period that you want to see up on the screen, who would it be?
Well, now, do you have to ask me?
Oh, come on.
No, come on. Well, you do.
Come on.
It's Grace O'Malley, definitely.
Yeah. Who, of course.
Fast second, Eleanor, Countess of Desmond, whom also was a part of all of that Tudor period, yeah. So hopefully that this will raise the
bar
profile.
And that might happen. Mm. Well, listen, thanks all to all three of you for speaking to us about the Tudors. That's Anne Chambers, Jerry Sembridge and Chris Wasser. And we await the Hilary Mantel book, The Mirror and the Light, soon to be published.